in the end. I had to swear I'd never publicise what he wrote me, or give the letters to the press. But I'm the only member of a victim's family he's ever been allowed direct contact with. And there, he said, turning the next two sheets of paper towards Robin, that's what I got back. The letter was written on prison writing paper. There was no, Dear Mr. Tucker. Your letter reached me 3 weeks ago, but I was placed in solitary confinement shortly afterwards and deprived of writing materials, so have been unable to answer. Ordinarily, I'm not permitted to respond to inquiries like yours, but I gather your persistence has worn the authorities down. Unlikely as it may seem, I admire you for this, Mr. Tucker. Resilience in the face of adversity is one of my own defining characteristics. During my 3 weeks of enforced solitude, I've wondered how I could possibly explain to you what not one man in 10,000 might hope to understand. Although you think I must be able to recall the names, faces, and personalities of my various victims, my memory shows me only the many-limbed, many-breasted monster with whom I cavorted, a foul-smelling thing that gave tongue to pain and misery. Ultimately, my monster was never much of a companion, though there was a fascination in its contortions. Given sufficient stimulus, it could be raised to an ecstasy of pain, and then it knew it lived, and stood tremulously on the edge of the abyss, begging, screaming, pleading for mercy. How many times did the monster die, then live again? Too few to satisfy me. Even though its face and voice mutated, its reactions never varied. Richard Meriden, my old psychiatrist, gave what possessed me other names, but the truth is that I was in the grip of a divine frenzy. Colleagues of Meriden's disputed his conclusion that I'm sane. Regrettably, their opinions were dismissed by the judge. In conclusion, I might have killed your daughter, or I might not. Either I did so in the grip of some madness which still occludes my memory, and which a more skilful doctor might yet penetrate, or I never met her, and little Louise is out there somewhere, laughing at her daddy's attempts to find her, or perhaps enduring a different hell to the one in which my monster lived. Doubtless the additional psychiatric support available at Broadmoor would help me recover as much memory as possible. For their own inscrutable reasons, however, the authorities prefer to keep me here at Belmarsh. Only this morning I was threatened under the noses of warders. Regardless of the obvious fact that a cachet attaches to anyone who attacks me, I'm exposed, daily, to intimidation and physical danger. How anyone expects me to regain sufficient mental health to assist police further is a mystery. Exceptional people ought to be studied only by those who can appreciate them. Rudimentary analysis, such as I've been subjected to thus far, merely entrenches my inability to recollect all that I did. Maybe you, Mr. Tucker, can help me. Until I'm in a hospital environment where I can be given the assistance I require, what incentive do I have to dredge my fragmented memory for details that may help you discover what happened to your daughter? My safety is being compromised on a daily basis. My mental faculties are being degraded. You will naturally be disappointed not to receive confirmation of what happened to Louise. Be assured that, when the frenzy is not upon me, I am not devoid of human sympathy. Even my worst critics concede that I actually understand others much more easily than they understand me. For instance, I can appreciate what it would mean to you to recover Louise's body and give her the funeral you so desire. On the other hand, my small store of human empathy is being rapidly depleted by the conditions in which I am currently living. Recovery from the last attack upon me, which nearly removed my eye, was delayed due to the refusal of the authorities to let me attend a civilian hospital. Evil men forfeit the right to fair treatment. Such seems to be the public's view. However, brutality breeds brutality. Even the most dim-witted psychiatrists agree there. Do you have a merciful soul, Mr. Tucker? If so, the first letter you'll write upon receiving this will be to the authorities, requesting that the remainder of my sentence will be served in Broadmoor, where the secrets my unruly memory still holds may be coaxed to the surface at last. Ever yours, Dennis. Robin finished reading and looked up.
"You can't see it, can you?"
said Tucker, with an oddly hungry expression.
"No, of course you can't. It isn't obvious. I didn't see it myself at first. Nor did the prison authorities. They were too busy warning me they weren't going to transfer him to Broadmoor, so I needn't ask."
He jabbed the bottom of the letter with a yellow-nailed finger.
"The clue's there. Last line. First letter. My sentence. Put together the first letter of every sentence and see what you get."
Robin did as she was bidden. Y-O-U-R. D-A-U-G-H-T-E-R. Robin read out loud, until fearing where the message was going to end, she fell silent until she reached the last sentence, when the taste of milky coffee seemed to turn rancid in her mouth. And she said, "Oh, God." The message in full read, "Your daughter cried for her mummy before she died."
"What's it say?"
asked Lauren, frowning and straining to see.
"Never you mind,"
said Tucker shortly, taking the letter back.
"There you are,"
he told Robin, folding up the papers and shoving them back into his inside pocket.
"Now you see what he is. He killed Lou like he killed your doctor, and he's gloating about it."
Before Robin could say anything, Tucker spun his next piece of paper to face her, and she saw a photocopied map of Islington, with a circle inked around what looked like a large house.
"Now,"
he said,
"there are two places nobody's ever looked, where I think he might have hid bodies. I've been back over everywhere what had a connection with him, kid or adult. Police checked all the obvious flats he'd lived in and that, but never bothered with these. When Lou disappeared in November 72, he wouldn't have been able to bury her in Epping Forest because..."
"They just found Vera Kenny's body there," said Robin. Tucker looked grudgingly impressed.
"You do your own work at that agency, don't you?" "Yeah, exactly. There was still a police presence in the forest at the time." "But see that there,"
said Tucker, tapping on the marked building.
"That's a private house now, but in the 70s it was the Archer Hotel. And guess who used to do their laundry? Creed's dry cleaners. He used to pick up stuff from them once a week in his van and bring it back again, sheets and bedspreads and what have you. Anyway, after he was arrested, the woman who owned the Archer Hotel gave a quote to the Mail, saying he always seemed so nice and polite, always chatty when he saw her." "That isn't marked on modern maps,"
said Tucker, now moving his finger to a cross marked in the grounds of the property.
"But it's on the old deeds. There's a well at the back of that property, just a shaft into the ground that collects rainwater. Predated the current building. I tracked down the owner in 89 after she'd sold up. She told me the well was boarded up in her time, and she planted bushes round it, because she didn't want no kid going down it accidental. But Creed used to go through that garden to deliver laundry, right past the place where the well was. He'll have known it was there. She couldn't remember telling him,"
said Tucker quickly, forestalling Robin's question.
"But that's neither here nor there, is it? She wasn't going to remember every word they said to her, was she, after all that time? Dead of night, Creed could have pulled up a van by the rear entrance, gone in through the back gate. And by the time I realised all this,"
said Tucker, gritting his brown teeth in frustration,
"the Archer had gone back to being a private property. And now there's been a bloody conservatory built over the old well."
"Don't you think," said Robin cautiously, "when they built over it, they might have noticed?"
"Why would they?" said Tucker aggressively. "I never knew a builder who went looking for work when he could just slap concrete over it. Anyway, Creed's not stupid. He'd have thrown rubbish down there on top of the body, wouldn't he? Cover it up. So that's a possibility," he said firmly. "And then you got this."
Tucker's last piece of paper was a second map.
"That there,"
he said, tapping his swollen knuckled finger on another circled building,
"is Dennis Creed's great-grandmother's house. It's mentioned in The Demon of Paradise Park. Creed said in one of his interviews, the only time he ever saw countryside when he was a kid was when he got taken there. And look here, said Tucker, pointing on a large patch of green. The house backs right onto Great Church Wood. Acres of woodland, acres and acres. Creed knew the way there. He had a van. He'd played in those woods as a child. We know he chose Epping Forest for most of the bodies, because he had no known connection with the place. But by 75, police were regularly checking Epping Forest by night, weren't they? But here's a different wood he knows, and it's not so far away from London, and Creed's got his van and his spades ready in the back. My best guess, said Tucker, is my Lou and your Doc are in the well or in the woods. And they've got different technology now to what they had in the 70s. Ground-penetrating radar and what have you. It wouldn't be difficult to see if there was a body in either of those places, not if the will was there. But, said Tucker, sweeping the two maps off the table and folding them up with his shaking hands, there's no will, or there hasn't been, not for years. Nobody in authority cares. They think it's all over. They think Creed will never talk. So that's why it's got to be your boss who interviews him. I wish it could be me, said Tucker. But you've seen what Creed thought I was worth.
As Tucker slid his papers back inside his windcheater, Robin became aware that the cafe around them had filled up during their conversation. At the nearest table sat three young men, all with amusingly Edwardian beards. So long attuned only to Tucker's low, hoarse voice, Robin's ears seemed suddenly full of noise. She felt as though she'd suddenly been transported from the distant past into a brash and indifferent present. What would Margot Bamborough, Louise Tucker, and Cara Wolfson make of the mobile phones in almost every hand, or the sound of Pharrell Williams's Happy now playing somewhere nearby, or the young woman carrying a coffee back from the counter, her hair in high bunches, wearing a T-shirt that read, Go Fuck Yourselfie. Don't cry, Grandad, said yellow-haired Lauren softly, putting her arm around her grandfather as a fat tear rolled down his swollen nose and fell upon the wooden table. Now that he'd stopped talking about Louise and Creed, he seemed to have become smaller. It's affected our whole family, Lauren told Robin. Mum and Auntie Lisa are always scared if me and my cousins go out after dark.
Quite right, said Tucker, who was now mopping his eyes on his sleeve again.
And all us grew up knowing it's something that can really happen, you know, said the innocent-faced Lauren. People really do disappear. They really do get murdered.
Yes, said Robin. I know. She reached across the table and briefly gripped the old man's forearm.
We'll do everything we can, Mr. Tucker, I promise. I'll be in touch.
As she left the cafe, Robin was aware that she'd just spoken for Strike, who knew absolutely nothing of the plan to interview Creed, let alone to try and find out what had happened to Louise Tucker. But she had no energy left to worry about that just now. Robin drew her jacket more closely around her and walked back to the office, her thoughts consumed by the terrible vacuum left in the wake of the vanished.
Chapter 52 Oft fire is without smoke. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, and Strike was driving towards Stoke Newington to relieve Robin, who was currently keeping watch over the terraced house that Shifty's boss was again visiting, and where he was almost certainly indulging in another bout of the blackmailable behaviour Shifty had somehow found out about. Even though Shifty's hold on his boss had driven the latter onto Tower Bridge, S.B. didn't appear able or willing to give up whatever it was he was doing inside the house of Eleanor Dean. The night was crisp and clear, although the stars overhead were only dimly visible from brightly lit Essex Road, and Barclay's voice was currently issuing from the speaker of the BMW. A week had passed since a Scot had managed to persuade S.B. to leave Tower Bridge and get a coffee with him.
"He cannot help himself, the poor bastard."
"Clearly," said Strike. "This is his third visit in 10 days.
He said to me, I can't stop. Says it relieves his stress."
"How does he square that with the fact he's suicidal?"
It's the blackmail that's making him suicidal, Strake. Not whatever he gets up to in Stoke Newington.
And he didn't give any indication what he does in there.
I told you. He said he doesn't shagger, but that his wife will leave him if he gets out. Could be rubber,
added Barclay, thoughtfully.
What? Rubber,
repeated Barclay.
Like that guy we had who liked wearing latex to work under his suit.
Oh, yeah, said Strike. I forgot about him. The various sexual predilections of their clients often blurred in Strike's memory. He could hear the hum of the casino in the background. Shifty had been in there for hours, and Barclay had been keeping him company, unnoticed, from across the floor.
Anyway, said Barclay, you want me to stay here, do you? Because it's costing a small fortune, and you say the client's getting pissy about how much we're charging. I could watch when the slimy bastard leaves from outside on the street.
No, stay on him, keep photographing him, and try and get something incriminating, said Strike.
Shifty's coked out of his head, said Barclay.
Half his colleagues will be cokeheads as well. We're going to need something worse than that to nail the bastard for blackmailing people onto high bridges.
You're going soft, Strike.
Just try and get something on the fucker and don't place large bets.
It's not the gambling that'll bankrupt us, said Barclay. It's the drinks.
He hung up, and Strike wound down the window and lit a cigarette, trying to ignore the pain in his stiff neck and shoulders. Like S.B., Strike could have used a respite from life's problems and challenges, but such outlets were currently non-existent. Over the past year, Joan's illness had taken from him that small sliver of time that wasn't given over to work. Since his amputation, he no longer played any kind of sport. He saw friends infrequently due to the demands of the agency, and derived many more headaches than pleasures from his relatives, who were being particularly troublesome just now. Tomorrow was Easter Sunday, meaning that Joan's family would be gathering together in St. Maur's to scatter her ashes at sea. Quite apart from the mournful event itself, Strike wasn't looking forward to yet another long journey to Cornwall, or to further enforced contact with Lucy, who'd made it clear over the course of several phone calls that she was dreading this final farewell. Again and again she returned to her sadness at not having a grave to visit, and Strike detected an undertone of blame, as though she thought Strike ought to have overruled Joan's dying wishes. Lucy had also expressed disappointment that Strike wasn't coming down for the whole weekend, as she and Greg were, and added bluntly that he'd better remember to bring Easter eggs for all three of his nephews, not just Jack. Strike could have done without transporting three fragile chocolate eggs all the way to Truro on the train, with a hold-all to manage and his leg sore from days and weeks of non-stop work. To compound his stress, both his unknown half-sister Prudence and his half-brother Al had started texting him again. His half-siblings seemed to imagine that Strike, having enjoyed a moment of necessary catharsis by shouting at Ropey over the phone, was probably regretting his outburst and more amenable to attending his father's party to make up. Strike hadn't answered any of their texts, but he'd experienced them as insect bites. Determined not to scratch, they were nevertheless the source of a niggling aggravation. Overhanging every other worry was the Bamborough case, which, for all the hours he and Robin were putting into it, was proving as opaque as it had when they'd first agreed to tackle the 40-year-old mystery. The year's deadline was coming ever closer, and nothing resembling a breakthrough had yet occurred. If he was honest, Strike had low hopes of the interview with Wilma Bayliss's daughters, which he and Robin would be conducting later that morning, before Strike boarded the train to Truro. All in all, as he drove towards the house of the middle-aged woman for whom S.B. seemed to feel such an attraction, Strike had to admit he felt a glimmer of sympathy for any man in desperate search of what the detective was certain was some form of sexual release. Recently, it had been brought home to Strike that the relationships he'd had since leaving Charlotte, casual though they'd been, had been his only unalloyed refuge from the job. His sex life had been moribund since Joan's diagnosis of cancer. All those lengthy trips to Cornwall had eaten up time that might have been given to dates. Which wasn't to say he hadn't had opportunities. Ever since the agency had become successful, a few of the rich and unhappy women who'd formed a staple of the agency's work had shown a tendency to size up Strike as a potential palliative for their own emotional pain or emptiness. Strike had taken on a new client of exactly this type the previous day, Good Friday, as she'd replaced Mrs. Smith, who'd already initiated divorce proceedings against her husband on the basis of Morris's pictures of him with their nanny. They'd nicknamed the 32-year-old brunette Miss Jones. She was undeniably beautiful, with long legs, full lips, and skin of expensive smoothness. She was of interest to the gossip columns partly because she was an heiress, and partly because she was involved in a bitter custody battle with her estranged boyfriend, on whom she was seeking dirt to use in court. Miss Jones had crossed and recrossed her long legs while she told Strike about her hypocritical ex-partner's drug use and the fact that he was feeding stories about her to the papers, and that he had no interest in his 6-month-old daughter other than as a means to make Miss Jones unhappy. While he was seeing her to the door, their interview concluded, she'd repeatedly touched his arm and laughed longer than necessary at his mild pleasantries. Trying to usher her politely out of the door under Pat's censorious eye, Strike had had the sensation of trying to prise chewing gum off his fingers. Strike could well imagine Dave Polworth's comments had he been privy to the scene, because Polworth had trenchant theories about the sort of women who found his oldest friend attractive, and of whom Charlotte was the purest example of the type. The women most readily drawn to Strike were, in Polworth's view, neurotic, chaotic, and occasionally dangerous, and their fondness for the bent-nosed ex-boxer indicated a subconscious desire for something rock-like to which they could attach themselves like limpets. Driving through the deserted streets of Stoke Newington, Strike's thoughts turned naturally to his ex-fiancée. He hadn't responded to the desperate text messages she'd sent him from what he knew, having Googled the place, to be a private psychiatric clinic. Not only had they arrived on the eve of his departure for Joan's deathbed, he hadn't wanted to fuel her vain hopes that he would appear to rescue her. Was she still there? If so, it would be her longest ever period of hospitalization. Her 1-year-old twins were doubtless in the care of a nanny, or the mother-in-law Charlotte had once assured him was ready and willing to take over maternal duties. A short distance away from Eleanor Dean Street, Strike called Robin.
Is he still inside?
Yes, you'll be able to park right behind me. There's a space. I think number 14 must have gone away for Easter with the kids. Both cars are gone.
See you in 5.
When Strike turned into the street, he saw the old Land Rover parked a few houses down from Eleanor's front door and was able to park without difficulty in the space directly behind it. As he turned off his engine, Robin jumped down out of her Land Rover, closed the door quietly, and walked around the BMW to the passenger side, a messenger bag over her shoulder.
"Morning," she said, sliding into the seat beside him.
"Morning. Aren't you keen to get away?"
As he said it, the screen of the mobile in her hand lit up. Somebody had texted her. Robin didn't even look at the message, but turned the phone over on her knee to hide its light.
"Got a few things to tell you. I've spoken to C.B. Oakden."
"Ah," said Strike.
Given that Oakden seemed primarily interested in Strike, and that Strike suspected Oakden was recording his calls, the two detectives had agreed that it should be Robin who warned him away from the case.
"He didn't like it," said Robin. "There was a lot of 'it's a free country and I'm entitled to talk to anyone I like.' I said to him, trying to get in ahead of us and talk to witnesses could hamper our investigation. He said, as an experienced biographer..."
"Oh, fuck off," said Strike under his breath.
"He knows how to question people to get information out of them, and it might be a good idea for the three of us to pool our resources."
"Yeah," said Strike. "That's exactly what this agency needs, a convicted con man on the payroll. How did you leave it?"
"Well, I can tell he really wants to meet you, and I think he's determined to withhold everything he knows about Brenner until he comes face to face with you. He wants to keep Brenner as bait."
Strike reached for another cigarette.
"I'm not sure Brenner's worth C.B. Oakden."
"Even after what Janice said?"
Strike took a drag on the cigarette, then blew smoke out of the window, away from Robin.
"I grant you, Brenner looks a lot fishier now than he did when we started digging. But what are the odds Oakden's actually got useful information? He was a kid when all this happened, and nicking that obituary smacks of a man trying to scrape up things to say rather than..."
He heard a rustling beside him, and turned to see Robin opening her messenger bag. Slightly to his surprise, Robin was pulling out Talbot's notebook again.
"Still carrying that around with you, are you?"
said Strike, trying not to sound exasperated.
"Apparently I am," she said, moving her mobile onto the dashboard so that she could open the book in her lap.
Watching the phone, Strike saw a second text arrive, lighting up the screen, and this time he caught sight of the name. Morris.
"What's Morris texting you about?" Strike said, and even to his ears the question sounded critical.
"Nothing. He's just bored sitting outside Miss Jones's boyfriend's house," said Robin, who was flicking through Talbot's notebook. "I want to show you something. There. Look at that."
She passed him the book, open to a page Strike remembered from his own perusal of the notes. It was close to the end of the notebook, where the pages were most heavily embellished with strange drawings. In the middle of this page danced a black skeleton holding a scythe. "Ignore all the weird tarot drawings," said Robin. "Look there, though. That sentence between the skeleton's legs. The little symbol, the circle with the cross in it, stands for the part of fortune."
"What's that?" asked Strike.
"It's a point in the horoscope that's supposed to be about worldly success. Part of fortune in second, money and possessions, and mother's house, underlined. The Ogdens lived on Fortune Street, remember? And the part of fortune was in the house of money and possessions when Margot disappeared. And he's connecting that with the fact that Dorothy inherited her mother's house, and saying that wasn't a tragedy, but a stroke of luck for Dorothy."
"You think?" said Strike, rubbing his tired eyes.
"Yes, because look, he then starts rambling about Virgo, which is Dorothy's sign under both systems, being petty and having an axe to grind, which, from what we know about her, fits. Anyway," said Robin, "I've been looking at dates of birth, and guess what? Under both the traditional and Schmidt systems, Dorothy's mother was a Scorpio."
"Christ's sake, how many more Scorpios are we going to find?"
"I know what you mean," said Robin, unfazed. "But from what I've read, Scorpio's one of the most common birth signs. Anyway, this is the important bit. Carl Ogden was born on the 6th of April. That means he's Aries under the traditional system, but Pisces under Schmidt's."
A short silence followed.
"How old was Ogden when his grandmother fell downstairs?" asked Strike.
14, said Robin.
Strike turned his face away from Robin to blow smoke out of the window again.
"You think he pushed his grandmother, do you?"
"It might not have been deliberate," said Robin. "He could have pushed past her and she lost her balance."
"Margot confronted Pisces. It'd be hell of a thing to accuse a child of."
"Maybe she never confronted him at all. The confrontation might have been something Talbot suspected or imagined. Either way..."
"It's suggestive, yeah. It is suggestive."
Strike let out a slight groan.
"We're going to have to interview bloody Ogden, aren't we? There's a bit of a hot spot developing around that little grouping, isn't there? Brenner and the Ogdens, outward respectability,
inward poison, remember? That's what Una Kennedy said about Dorothy."
The detective sat for a moment or two, watching Eleanor Dean's front door, which remained closed, her dark garden silent and still.
"How many murders," Robin asked, "do you think go undetected?"
"Clue's in the question, isn't it? Undetected, impossible to know. But yeah, it's those quiet domestic deaths you wonder about. Vulnerable people picked off by their own families, and everyone thinking it was ill health."
"Or a mercy that they've gone," said Robin.
"Some deaths are a mercy," said Strike.
And with these words, in both of their minds' eyes rose an image of horror. Strike was remembering the corpse of Sergeant Gary Topley, lying on the dusty road in Afghanistan, eyes wide open, his body missing from the waist down. The vision had recurred in Strike's nightmares ever since he'd seen it, and occasionally, in these dreams, Gary talked to him, lying in the dust. It was always a comfort to remember, on waking, that Gary's consciousness had been snuffed out instantly, that his wide-open eyes and puzzled expression showed that death had claimed him before his brain could register agony or terror. But in Robin's mind there was a picture of something she wasn't sure had ever happened. She was imagining Margot Bamborough chained to a radiator. "I whip her face and breasts, pleading for her life, The strategy is laughably transparent. And suffering torments, it could be raised to an ecstasy of pain, and then it knew it lived, and stood tremulously on the edge of the abyss, begging, screaming, begging for mercy. "You know," said Robin, talking partly to break the silence and dispel that mental image, "I quite like to find a picture of Dorothy's mother, Maud."
"Why?"
"For confirmation, because I don't think I told you. Look." She flipped backwards in the notebook to the page littered with water signs. In small writing beneath a picture of a scorpion were the words, "Mole," brackets, "Adams."
"Is that a new sign?" asked Strike. "The mole?"
"No," said Robin, smiling. "Talbot's alluding to the fact that the astrologer, Evangeline Adams, said the true Scorpio often has a birthmark or a prominent mole. I've read her book, got it second hand." There was a pause.
"What?"
said Strike, because Robin was looking at him expectantly.
"I was waiting for you to jeer." "I lost the will to jeer some way back," said Strike. "You realize we're supposed to have solved this case in approximately 14 weeks' time?"
"I know," sighed Robin. She picked up her mobile to check the time, and out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw yet another text from Morris. "Well, we're meeting the Bayliss sisters later. Maybe they'll have something useful to tell us. Are you sure you want to interview them with me? I'd be fine to do it alone. You're going to be really tired after sitting here all night."
"I'll sleep on the train to Truro afterwards," said Strike. "You got any plans for Easter Sunday?"
"No," said Robin. "Mum wanted me to go home, but..." Strike wondered what the silent sequel to the sentence was, and whether she'd made plans with someone else and didn't want to tell him about it. Morris, for instance. "Okay, I swear this is the last thing I'm going to bring up from Talbot's notebook," Robin said. "But I want to flag something up before we meet the Baylisses."
"Go on."
"You said yourself he seemed racist from his notes."
"Black Phantom," Strike quoted.
"Yeah. And Black Moon Lilith."
"And wondering whether she was a witch."
"Exactly. I think he really harassed her, and probably the family too," Robin said. "The language he uses for Wilma, crude, dishonest." Robin flicked back to the page featuring the three horn signs, and, "woman as she is now in his eon, armed and militant."
"A radical feminist witch."
"Which sounds quite cool when you say it," said Robin. "But I don't think Talbot meant it that way."
"You think this is why the daughters didn't want to talk to us?"
"Maybe," said Robin. "So I think we need to be, you know, sensitive to what might have gone on. Definitely not go in there looking as though we suspect Wilma of anything."
"Point well made and taken," said Strike.
"Right then," said Robin with a sigh, as she put the notebook back into her messenger bag. "I'd better get going." "What is he doing in there?" Robin asked quietly, looking at Eleanor Dean's front door.
"Barclay thinks it might be a rubber fetish.
He'd need a lot of talcum powder to wriggle himself into anything made of rubber, the size of that belly." Strike laughed. "Well, I'll see you in..." Robin checked the time on her mobile. 7 hours, 45 minutes.
"Sleep well," said Strike.
As she walked away from the BMW, Strike saw her looking at her mobile again, doubtless reading Morris's texts. He watched as she got into the ancient Land Rover, then turned the tank-like vehicle in a three-point turn, raising a hand in farewell as she passed him, heading back to Earl's Court. As Strike reached for the thermos of tea under his seat, he remembered the supposed dental appointment of the other day, about which Robin had sounded strangely flustered, and which had taken place, though Strike hadn't previously made the connection, on Morris's afternoon off. A most unwelcome possibility crossed his mind. Had Robin lied like Irene Hickson, and for the same reason? His mind darted to what Robin had said a few months previously, when she'd mentioned her ex-husband having a new partner. "Oh, I didn't tell you, did I? I told Morris." As he unscrewed his thermos, Strike mentally reviewed Robin's behaviour around Morris in the last few months. She'd never seemed to particularly like him, but might that have been an act designed to deflect attention? Were his partner and his subcontractor actually in a relationship which he, busy with his own troubles,
had failed to spot. Strike poured himself tea, settled back in his seat, and glowered at Eleanor Dean's closed door through the steam rising from plastic-tasting tea the colour of mud. He was angry, he told himself, because he should have established a work rule that partners weren't allowed to date subcontractors, and for another reason which he preferred not to examine, because he knew perfectly well what it was, and no good could come of brooding upon it. Chapter 53. Like three fair branches budding far and wide, that from one root derive their vital sap, and like that root that doth her life divide, their mother was. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. 7 hours later, in the cool flat daylight of an overcast morning, Robin, who was back in her Land Rover, took a detour on her way to the cafe where she and Strike would be meeting the three Bayliss sisters. When Maya, the middle sister, had suggested meeting in Belgique in Wanstead, Robin had realised how close she'd have to drive to the flats where Dennis Creed had disposed of his second-to-last known victim, 27-year-old hairdresser Susan Mayer. Half an hour ahead of the planned interview, Robin parked the Land Rover beside a stretch of shops on Aldersbrook Road, then crossed the street and headed up a short footpath which led her to the reedy bank of the man-made Alexandra Lake, a wide stretch of water on which various wildfowl were bobbing. A couple of ducks came paddling hopefully towards Robin, but when she failed to produce bread or other treats, they glided away again, compact, self-sufficient, their onyx eyes scanning both water and bank for other possibilities. 39 years ago, Dennis Creed had driven to this lake under cover of night and rolled the headless, handless corpse of Susan Mayer into it, bound up in black plastic and rope. Susan Mayer's distinctive wedge cut and shy smile had earned her a prominent place on the cover of The Demon of Paradise Park. The milky sky looked as opaque as the shallow lake, which resembled jade silk in which the gliding wildfowl made rippling creases. Hands in her pockets, Robin looked out over the water and the rustling weeds, trying to imagine the scene when a park worker had spotted the black object in the water, which he'd assumed initially was a tarpaulin swollen with air, until he hooked it with a long pole, felt the grisly weight, and made an instant connection. Or so he told the television crew, who arrived shortly after the police and ambulance, with the bodies that kept turning up in Epping Forest, barely 10 miles away. Creed had abducted Susan exactly a month before Margot disappeared. Had they overlapped in Creed's basement? If so, had Creed, for a brief period, held three women there simultaneously? Robin preferred not to think about what Andrea, or Margot, if she'd been there, must have felt on being dragged into Creed's basement, seeing a fellow woman chained there, and knowing that she, too, would be reduced to that emaciated and broken-boned state before she died. Andrea Hooton was the last woman Creed was known to have killed, and he'd varied the pattern when it came to disposing of her body, driving 80 miles from his house in Liverpool Road to throw the corpse off Beachy Head. Both Epping Forest and Wanstead Flats had become too heavily patrolled by then, and in spite of Creed's evident wish to make sure the Essex butcher was credited with every kill, as evidenced by the secret store of press clippings he kept beneath the floorboards in his basement flat, he'd never wanted to be caught. Robin checked her watch. It was time to head to the interview with the Bayliss sisters. Walking back to the Land Rover, she pondered the divide between normalcy and insanity. On the surface, Creed had been far saner than Bill Talbot. Creed had left no half-crazed scribblings behind him to explain his thought processes. He'd never plotted the course of asteroids to guide him. His interviews with psychiatrists and police had been entirely lucid. Not for Creed the belief in signs and symbols, a secret language decipherable only by initiates, a refuge in mystery or magic. Dennis Creed had been a meticulous planner, a genius of misdirection in his neat little white van, dressed in the pink coat he'd stolen from Vi Cooper, and sometimes wearing a wig that, from a distance, to a drunk victim, gave his hazy form a feminine appearance just long enough for his large hands to close over a gasping mouth.
When Robin arrived in the street where the cafe stood, she spotted Strike getting out of his BMW a short distance away from the entrance. Noticing the Land Rover in turn, Strike raised a hand in greeting and headed up the street towards her, while finishing what looked like a bacon and egg McMuffin, his chin stubbly, the shadows beneath his eyes purple.
"Have I got time for a fag?"
were the first words he spoke, checking his watch as Robin got down out of the car and slammed the door. "No," he answered himself with a sigh.
"Oh, well, you can take the lead on this interview," he told Robin,
as they headed together towards the cafe.
"You've done all the legwork. I'll take notes. Remind me what their names are."
"Eden's the eldest. She's a Labour councillor from Lewisham. Maya's the middle one, and she's deputy headmistress of a primary school. The youngest is Portia Dagley, and she's a social worker."
"Like her mother?"
"Exactly. And she lives just up the road from here. I think we've come to her neck of the woods because she's been ill, so the others didn't want her to have to travel." Robin pushed open the door of the cafe and led the way inside. The interior was sleekly modern, with a curved counter, a wooden floor, and a bright orange feature wall. Close to the door at a table for six sat three black women. Robin found it easy to identify which sister was which because of the photographs she'd seen on the family's Facebook pages and on the Lewisham Council website. Eden, the councillor, sat with her arms folded, a wavy bob casting a shadow over most of her face, so that only a carefully lipsticked, unsmiling plum mouth was clearly visible. She wore a well-tailored black jacket, and her demeanour was suggestive of a businesswoman who'd been interrupted during an important meeting. Maya, the deputy headmistress, wore a cornflower blue sweater and jeans. A small silver cross hung around her neck. She was smaller in build than Eden, the darkest-skinned and, in Robin's opinion, the prettiest of the sisters. Her long braided hair was tied back in a thick ponytail. She wore square-framed glasses over her large, wide-set eyes, and her full mouth, with its naturally up-tilted corners, conveyed warmth. A leather handbag sat in Maya's lap, and she was gripping it with both hands, as though afraid it might otherwise escape. Portia, the youngest sister and the social worker, was also the heaviest. Her hair had been cropped almost to her skull, doubtless because of her recent chemotherapy. She'd penciled in the eyebrows that were just beginning to grow back. They arched over hazel eyes that shone gold against her skin. Portia was wearing a purple smock top with jeans and long beaded earrings, which swung like miniature chandeliers as she looked around at Strike and Robin. As they approached the table, Robin spotted a small tattoo on the back of Portia's neck, the trident from the Barbadian flag. Robin knew that Eden and Maya were both well into their 50s, and that Portia was 49, but all three sisters could have passed for at least 10 years younger than their real ages. Robin introduced herself and Strike. Hands were shaken, Eden unsmiling throughout, and the detective sat down, Strike at the head of the table, Robin between him and Portia, facing Maya and Eden. Everyone but Eden made laboured small talk about the local area and the weather, until the waiter came to take their order. Once he'd left, Robin said, "Thanks very much for meeting us. We really do appreciate it. Would you mind if Cormoran takes notes?" Maya and Portia shook their heads. Strike tugged his notebook out of his coat pocket and opened it. "As I said on the phone," Robin began, "we're really after background, building up a complete picture of Margot Bamborough's life in the months."
"Could I ask a couple of questions?" interrupted Eden.
"Of course," said Robin politely, though expecting trouble. Eden swept her hair back out of her face, revealing ebony dark eyes.
"Did you two know there's a guy phoning around everyone who was connected to St. John's, saying he's going to write a book about you investigating Bamborough's disappearance?"
"Shit," thought Robin.
"Would this be a man called Oakden?" asked Strike.
"No, Carl Bryce."
"It's the same bloke," said Strike.
"Are you connected to him or—"
"No," said Strike, "and I'd strongly advise you not to talk to him."
"Yeah, we worked that one out for ourselves," said Eden coolly. "But this means there'll be publicity, won't there?"
Robin looked at Strike, who said,
"If we solve the case, there'll be publicity even without Oakden or Bryce or whatever he's calling himself these days. But that's a big if. To be frank, the odds are we're not going to solve it, in which case I think Oakden's going to find it very hard to sell any books, and whatever else you tell us will never go any further.
What if we know something that might help you solve the case, though? Asked Portia, leaning forwards so that she could look past Robin at Strike.
There was an infinitesimal pause in which Robin could almost feel Strike's interest sharpening along with her own.
Depends what that information is, Strike answered slowly. It might be possible not to divulge where we got it, but if the source is important to getting a conviction...
There was a long pause. The air between the sisters seemed charged with silent communications.
Well, said Porter at last, on an interrogative note.
We did decide to, Maya mumbled to Eden, who continued to sit in silence, arms folded.
Okay, fine,
said Eden, with a don't-blame-me-later inflection. The deputy headmistress reached absently for a little silver cross around her neck and held it as she began to talk.
I need to explain a bit of background first, she said. When we were kids, Eden and I were already teenagers, but Portia was only 9.
8, Portia corrected her.
8, Maya said obediently. Our dad was convicted of rape and sent to prison. He didn't do it, though, said Eden.
Robin reached automatically for her coffee cup and took a sip, so as to hide her face.
He didn't, okay? Said Eden, watching Robin. He had a white girlfriend for a couple of months. The whole of Clerkenwell knew. They'd been seen together in bars all over the place. He tried to end it, and she cried rape.
Robin's stomach lurched as though the floor had tilted. She very much wanted this story to be untrue. The idea of any woman lying about rape was repugnant to her. She'd had to talk through every moment of her own assault in court. Her soft-spoken 53-year-old rapist and would-be murderer had taken the stand afterwards to explain to the jury how the 20-year-old Robin had invited him into the stairwell of a hall of residence for sex. In his account, everything had been consensual. She'd whispered that she liked it rough, which had accounted for the heavy bruising around her neck. She'd enjoyed it so much she'd asked him back the following night, and yes, with a little laugh in the dock, of course he'd been surprised. Nicely spoken young girl like her, coming on to him like that, out of nowhere.
Easy thing for a white woman to do to a black man, said Eden, especially in 1972. Dad already had a record because he got into a fight a few years before that. He went down for 5 years.
Must have been hard on the family, said Strike, not looking at Robin.
It was, said Maya. Very hard. The other kids at school, well, you know what kids are like. Dad had been bringing in most of the money, said Portia. There were 5 of us, and Mum had never had much schooling. Before Dad got arrested, she'd been studying, trying to pass some exams, better herself. We were just about making ends meet while Dad was bringing in a wage, but once he was gone, we struggled. Our Mum and her sister married 2 brothers, said Maya. 9 children between them. The families were really close, right up until Dad got arrested. But then everything changed. My Uncle Marcus went to court every day while Dad was on trial, but Mum wouldn't go, and Uncle Marcus was really angry with her.
Well, he knew it would have made a big difference if the judge had seen Dad had the family united behind him, snapped Eden.
I went. I bunked off school to go. I knew he was innocent.
Well, good for you, said Portia, though her tone was far from congratulatory.
But Mum didn't want to sit in open court, listening to her husband talk about how often he had sex with his girlfriend.
That woman was trash, said Eden curtly.
Dirty water does cool hot iron,
said Portia, with a Bajan inflection.
His choice.
So, anyway, said Maya hastily.
The judge believed the woman, and Dad got put away. Mum never went to visit him inside, and she wouldn't take me or Portia or our brothers either.
I went, piped up Eden again. I got Uncle Marcus to take me. He was still our dad. Mum had no right to stop us seeing him.
Yeah, so, continued Maya, before Portia could say anything. Mum wanted a divorce, but she had no money for legal advice.
So Dr. Bamborough put her in touch with this feminist lawyer, who'd give legal help to women in difficult circumstances for a reduced fee. When Uncle Marcus told Dad that Mum had managed to get herself a lawyer, Dad wrote to her from prison, begging her to change her mind. He said he'd found God, that he loved her, and he'd learned his lesson, and all he wanted was his family. Maya took a sip of her coffee. About a week after Mum got Dad's letter, she was cleaning Dr. Bamborough's consulting room one evening after everyone had left, and she noticed something in the bin. Maya unfastened the handbag she'd been holding on her lap and took out a pale blue piece of heavily creased paper which had clearly been crumpled up into a ball at some point in the past. She held it out to Robin, who laid it flat on the table so that Strike could read it too. The faded handwriting was a distinctive mix of capitals and lowercase letters. "Leave my girl alone, you cunt, or I'll make sure you go to hell. Slow and painful." Robin glanced sideways at Strike and saw her own barely disguised astonishment mirrored there. Before either of them could say anything, a group of young women passed their table, forcing Strike to push his chair in. Chatting and giggling, the women sat down at the table behind Maya and Eden. "When Mum read that," said Maya, speaking more quietly so that the newcomers couldn't hear her, "she thought Dad had sent it. Not literally, because the prison censor would never have let that go out. She thought someone had done it for him." "Specifically, Uncle Marcus," said Eden, arms folded, an expression pinched. "Uncle Marcus, who was a lay preacher and never used the C-word in his life." "Mum took the note over to Uncle Marcus and Auntie Carmen's," said Maya, ignoring this interjection, "and asked Marcus straight out if he was behind it. He denied it, but Mum didn't believe him. It was the mention of hell. Marcus was a fire and brimstone kind of preacher back then, and he didn't believe Mum really wanted a divorce," said Portia. "He blamed Dr. Bamborough for persuading Mum to leave Dad, because, you know, Mum really needed a white woman to point out her life was shit. She'd never have noticed otherwise." "Going for a cigarette, okay?" said Eden abruptly. She pushed herself up and walked out, her heels rapping on the wooden floorboards. Both younger sisters seemed to exhale in relief with her departure. "She was Dad's favourite," Maya told Strike and Robin quietly, watching through the window as Eden took out a packet of Silk Cut, shook her hair out of her face, and lit herself a cigarette. "She really loved him, even if he was a womanizer. And she never got on with Mum," said Portia. "Their rows would have woken the dead." "In fairness," said Maya, "them splitting up hit Eden hardest. She left school at 16, got herself a job at Marks and Spencer to help support—" "Mum never wanted her to drop out of school," said Portia. "That was Eden's choice. Eden likes to claim it was a sacrifice she made for the family, but come on, she couldn't wait to get out of school, because Mum put so much pressure on her to get good grades. She likes to claim she was a second mother to all of us, but that's not how I remember it. I mostly remember her whacking merry hell out of me if I so much as looked at her wrong." On the other side of the window, Eden stood smoking with her back to them. "The whole situation was a nightmare," said Maya sadly. "Mum and Uncle Marcus never made it up, and with Mum and Carmen being sisters—" "Let's just tell them now, while she can't stick her oar in," Portia urged Maya, and turning to Strike and Robin, she said, "Auntie Carmen was helping Mum get the divorce behind Uncle Marcus's back." "How?" asked Robin, as a waiter passed their table on the way to the group of women at the next table. "See, when the lawyer Dr. Bamborough had recommended told Mum what she charged, Mum knew she'd never be able to afford her. Not even at the reduced rates," said Portia. "Mum came home afterwards and cried," said Maya, "because she was desperate to have the divorce done and dusted before Dad got out of jail. She knew otherwise he'd just move right back in and she'd be trapped. Anyway, a few days later, Dr. Bamborough asked her how things had gone with the lawyer, and Mum admitted she wasn't going to go through with the divorce for lack of funds, so—" Maya sighed. "Dr. Bamborough offered to pay the lawyer in exchange for Mum doing a few hours a week cleaning the house out in Ham." The woman at the table behind theirs were now flirting with the young waiter, wondering whether it was too early for a cream cake, giggling about breaking their diets. "Mum didn't feel she could refuse," said Maya. "But what with the costs of getting all the way out to Ham, and the time it would take her to get out there when she already had two other jobs and exams coming up. Your Aunt Carmen agreed to do the cleaning for her, guessed Robin. And out of the corner of her eye, she saw Strike glance at her.
Yeah, said Maya, eyes widening in surprise. Exactly. It seemed like a good solution. Auntie Carmen was a housewife and Uncle Marcus and Dr. Bamborough were both out at work all day, so Mum thought neither of them would ever know the wrong woman was turning up.
There was one sticky moment, said Portia. Remember, Em? When Dr. Bamborough asked us all over to a barbecue at her house. She turned to Robin. We couldn't go because Dr. Bamborough's nanny would have realised Mum wasn't the woman turning up once a week to clean. My Auntie Carmen didn't like that nanny, Portia added. Didn't like her at all.
Why was that? Asked Strike.
She thought the girl was after Dr. Bamborough's husband. Went red every time she said his name, apparently. The door of the cafe opened, and Eden walked back inside. As she sat down, Robin caught a whiff of smoke mingling with her perfume.
Where have you got to? She asked, looking cold.
Auntie Carmen cleaning instead of Mum, said Maya. Eden refolded her arms, ignoring her coffee.
So, the statement your mother gave to the police about the blood and Dr. Phipps walking across the garden, said Strike,
was really her telling him everything Carmen had told her, yeah, said Maya, feeling again for the cross around her neck. She couldn't own up that her sister had been going there instead of her, because my Uncle Marcus would have gone crazy if he'd found out. Auntie Carmen begged Mum not to tell the police, and Mum agreed.
So she had to pretend she was the one who'd seen the blood on the carpet and Dr. Phipps walking across the lawn.
Only,
interrupted Portia, with a humourless laugh, Carmen changed her mind about Dr. Phipps after. Mum went back to her after her first police interview and said, they're asking whether I couldn't have got confused and mistaken one of the workmen for Dr. Phipps, Carmen said. Oh, yeah, I forgot there were workmen round the back. Maybe I did.
Portia let out a short laugh, but Robin knew she wasn't truly amused. It was the same kind of laughter Robin had taken refuge in the night she discussed rape with Max over the kitchen table.
I know it isn't funny, said Portia, catching Maya's eye. But come on. Carmen was always ditzy as hell, but you'd think she might have made sure of her facts then, wouldn't you? Mum was literally sick with stress, like retching if she ate anything. And then that old bitch of a secretary at work found her having a dizzy spell.
Yeah, said Eden, suddenly coming to life. Next thing was, Mum was accused of being a thief and a drunk and the practice fired her. The old secretary claimed she'd had a secret sniff of Mum's thermos and smelled booze in it. Total fabrication.
That was a few months after Margot Bamborough disappeared, wasn't it? Asked Strike, his pen poised over his notebook.
Oh, I'm sorry, Eden said with icy sarcasm. Did I go off topic? Back to the missing white lady, everyone. Never mind what the black woman went through. Who gives a shit? Sorry, I didn't, began Strike.
Do you know who Tiana Medaney is? Eden shot at him.
No, he admitted. No, said Eden. Of course you bloody don't.
40 years after Margot Bamborough went missing, here we all are fussing over her and where she went. Tiana Medaney's a black teenager from Lewisham. She went missing last year. How many front pages has Tiana been on? Why wasn't she top of the news like Bamborough was? Because we're not worth the same, are we, to the press or to the bloody police?
Strike appeared unable to find an adequate response. Doubtless, Robin thought, because Eden's point was unarguable. The picture of Dennis Creed's only black victim, Jackie Eilert, a secretary and mother of one, was the smallest and the least distinct of the glossy black and white images of Creed's victims on the cover of The Demon of Paradise Park. Jackie's dark skin showed up worst on the gloomy cover. The greatest prominence had been given to 16-year-old Geraldine Christie and 27-year-old Susan Meyer, both of them pale and blonde.
When Margot Bamborough went missing, Eden said fiercely, the white women at her practice were treated like bone china by the police, okay? Practically mopping their bloody tears for them, but not our mum. They treated her like a hardened con. That policeman in charge, what was his name?
Talbot, suggested Robin.
What are you hiding? Come on, I know you're hiding something.
The mysterious figure of the Hierophant rose up in Robin's mind. The keeper of secrets and mysteries in the Thoth Tarot wore saffron robes and sat upon a bull. The card is referred to Taurus, and in front of him, half his size, stood a black priestess, her hair braided like Maya's. Before him is the woman girt with a sword. She represents the Scarlet Woman. Which had come first, the laying out of tarot cards signifying secrecy and concealment, or the policeman's instinct that the terrified Wilma was lying to him?
"When he interviewed me," began Eden.
"Talbot interviewed you?" asked Strike sharply.
"Yeah. He came to Marks and Spencer unannounced to my work," said Eden.
And Robin realized that Eden's eyes were suddenly bright with tears.
"Someone else at the practice had seen that anonymous note Bamborough got. Talbot found out Dad was inside, and he'd heard Mum was cleaning for the doctor. He went to every man in our family, accusing them of writing the threatening letters, and then he came to me, asking me really strange questions about all my male relatives, wanting to know what they'd been up to on different dates, asking whether Uncle Marcus often stayed out overnight. He even asked me about Dad and Uncle Marcus's
star signs?" asked Robin. Eden looked astounded.
"The hell did you know that?"
"Talbot left a notebook. It's full of occult writing. He was trying to solve the case using tarot cards and astrology."
"Astrology?" repeated Eden. "Effing astrology?"
"Talbot shouldn't have been interviewing you without an adult present," Strike told Eden.
"What were you, 16?
Eden laughed in the detective's face.
"That might be how it works for white girls, but we're different. Aren't you listening? We're hardy, we're tough. That occult stuff," Eden said, turning back to Robin.
"Yeah, that makes sense, because he asked me about Abaya. You know what that is?" Robin shook her head. "Kind of magic they used to practice in the Caribbean, originated in West Africa. We were all born in Southwark, but, you know, we were all black pagans to Inspector Talbot. He had me alone in the back room, and he was asking me stuff about rituals using blood, about black magic. I was terrified. I didn't know what he was on about. I thought he meant Mum and the blood on the carpet, hinting she'd done away with Dr. Bamborough."
"He was having a psychotic breakdown," said Robin. "That's why they took him off the case. He thought he was hunting a devil. Your mum wasn't the only woman he thought might have supernatural power."
"But he was definitely racist," Robin added quietly. "That's clear from his notes."
"You never told us about the police coming to Marks and Spencer," said Portia. "Why didn't you tell us?"
"Why would I?" said Eden, angrily blotting her damp eyes. "Mum was already ill with the stress of it all. I had Uncle Marcus shouting at me that Mum had put the police onto him and his boys. And I was really scared. If Uncle Marcus found out about the officer coming to my work, he'd report him, which was the last thing we needed."
"God, it was a mess," said Eden, pressing her hands briefly against her wet eyes. "Such a bloody mess."
Portia looked as though she'd like to say something comforting to her elder sister, but Robin had the impression that this would be such a departure from their usual relationship, she didn't know quite how to set about it. After a moment or two, Portia muttered, "Need the loo," pushed her chair away from the table, and disappeared into the bathroom.
"I didn't want Portia to come today," said Maya, as soon as the bathroom door swung shut behind her younger sister.
She was tactfully not looking at her elder sister, who was trying to pretend she wasn't crying, while surreptitiously wiping more tears from her eyes.
"She doesn't need this stress. She's only just finished chemo."
"How's she doing?" asked Strike.
"She was given the all clear last week, thank God. She's talking about going back to work on reduced hours. I think it's too early."
"She's a social worker, isn't she?" asked Robin.
"Yeah," sighed Maya. "A backlog of 100 desperate messages every morning. And you know you're in for the firing line if anything goes wrong with a family you haven't been able to reach. I don't know how she does it. But she's like Mum, two peas in a pod. She was always Mum's baby, and Mum was her hero."
Eden let out a soft, "Huh," which might have been agreement or disparagement. Maya ignored it. There was a short pause in which Robin reflected on the tangled ties of family. A proxy war between Jules and Wilma Bayliss seemed still to be playing out in the next generation. The bathroom door swung open again, and Portia reappeared. Instead of taking her seat beside Robin, she swiveled her wide hips around Strike at the end of the table and edged in behind a startled Maya, who pulled her chair in hastily until she reached Eden. After thrusting a handful of toilet roll into her elder sister's hand, Portia slid her plump arms around Eden's neck and dropped a kiss on the top of her head.
"What are you doing?"
said Eden huskily, reaching up to clasp her younger sister's arms, not to remove them, but to hold them there. Strike, Robin saw out of the corner of her eye, was pretending to examine his notebook.
"Thanking you," said Portia softly,
dropping another kiss on the top of her eldest sister's head before letting her go.
"For agreeing to do this. I know you didn't want to."
Everyone sat in slightly startled silence while Portia squeezed her way back around the table and resumed her seat next to Robin.
"Have you told them the last bit?" Portia asked Maya,
while Eden blew her nose.
"About Mum and Betty Fuller?"
"No,"
said Maya, who appeared shell-shocked by the act of reconciliation she'd just witnessed.
"You're the one Mum told it to. I think you should."
"Right," said Portia, turning to look at Strike and Robin. "This really is the last thing we know, and there might be nothing in it, but you might as well have it, now you know the other stuff." Strike waited, pen paused. "Mum told me this not long after she retired. She shouldn't have, really, because it was about a client. But when you hear what it was, you'll understand. Mum kept working in Clerkenwell after she qualified as a social worker. It was where all her friends were. She didn't want to move. So she really got to know the local community. One of the families she was working with lived in Skinner Street, not that far from the St. John's practice."
"Skinner Street?" repeated Strike.
The name rang a bell, but exhausted as he was, he couldn't immediately remember why that was. Robin, on the other hand, knew immediately why Skinner Street sounded familiar.
"Yeah, the family was called Fuller. They had just about every problem you can think of," Mum said. "Addiction, domestic abuse, criminality, the lot. The sort of head of the family was a grandmother who was only in her 40s, and this woman's main source of income was prostitution. Betty was her name. And Mum said she was like a local news service, if you wanted to know about the underworld anyway. The family had been in the area for generations. Anyway, one day Betty says to Mum, bit sly, to see her reaction, 'Marcus never sent no threatening notes to that doctor, you know.' Mum was gobsmacked," said Portia. "Her first thought was that Marcus was visiting the woman, you know, as a client."
"I know he wasn't," said Portia quickly, holding up a hand to forestall Eden, who'd opened her mouth. "Mum and Marcus hadn't spoken for years at this point. Anyway, it was all innocent. Betty had met Marcus because the church was doing a bit of outreach in the local area. He'd brought round some harvest festival stuff for the family and tried to persuade Betty to come along to a church service. Betty had worked out Marcus's connection with Mum, because Mum was still going by Bayliss, and Betty claimed she knew who really wrote the threatening notes to Margot Bamborough, and that the person who wrote the notes was the same person who killed her. Mum said, 'Who was it?' And Betty said, if she ever told, Margot's killer would kill her too." There was a short silence. The cafe clattered around them, and one of the women at the next table, who was eating a cream slice, said loudly, with unctuous pleasure,
"God, that's good!"
"Did your mother believe Betty?" asked Robin.
"She didn't know what to think," said Portia. "Betty knew some very rough people, so it was possible she'd heard something on the grapevine, but who knows? People talk, don't they? And they like making themselves important."
And Robin remembered Janice Beatty saying exactly this, as she passed on the rumour of Margot Bamborough appearing in the graveyard. "But if there was anything in it, a woman like Betty, she'd go to the moon before she went to the cops."
"She might well be dead by now," said Portia, "given her lifestyle. But for what it's worth, there it is. Shouldn't be hard to find out whether she's still alive."
"Thanks very much for telling us," said Strike. "That's definitely worth following up."
Having told all they knew, the three sisters now lapsed into a pained silence. It wasn't the first time that Robin had had cause to consider how much collateral damage each act of violence left in its wake. The disappearance of Margot Bamborough had evidently wreaked havoc in the lives of the Bayliss girls, and now she knew the full extent of the grief it had brought them, and the painful nature of the memories associated with it, she perfectly understood Eden's initial refusal to talk to detectives. If anything, she had to ask herself why the sisters had changed their minds.
"Thank you so much for this," she said sincerely. "I know Margot's daughter will be incredibly grateful that you agreed to talk to us."
"Oh, it's the daughter who's hired you, is it?" said Maya.
"Well, you can tell her from me. Mum felt guilty all her life that she didn't come clean with the police. She liked Dr. Bamborough, you know. I mean, they weren't close friends or anything, but she thought she was a decent person. It weighed on her," said Portia. "Right up until her death, it weighed on her. That's why she kept that note. She'd have wanted us to do this. There's always handwriting analysis and stuff, isn't there?"
Strike agreed that there was. He went to pay the bill, and Robin waited at the table with the sisters, who she could tell wanted the detectives gone and as quickly as possible. They disclosed their personal trauma and their family's secrets, and now a thin layer of polite small talk was too onerous to sustain, and any other form of conversation impossible. Robin was relieved when Strike rejoined her, and after brief farewells, the two of them left the cafe. The moment he hit clean air, Strike paused to pull his Benson and Hedges out of his pocket and lit one.
"Needed that," he muttered as they walked on. "So, Skinner Street
is where Joseph Brenner was seen on the night Margot Bamborough disappeared," said Robin.
"Ah," muttered Strike, briefly closing his eyes. "I knew there was something."
"I'll look into Betty Fuller as soon as I get home," said Robin. "What did you think of the rest of it?"
"The Bayliss family really went through it, didn't they?" said Strike, pausing beside the Land Rover and glancing back at the cafe.
His BMW lay another 50 yards ahead. He took another drag on his cigarette, frowning.
"You know, it gives us another angle on Talbot's bloody notebook," he admitted. "Strip away all the occult shit, and he was right, wasn't he? Wilma was hiding stuff from him. A lot of stuff, actually."
"I thought that too," said Robin.
"You realize that threatening note's the first piece of physical evidence we found?"
"Yes," said Robin, checking her watch. "What time are you heading to Truro?"
Strike didn't answer.
Looking up, Robin saw that he was staring so fixedly across the open park on the other side of the road that she turned too, to see what had captured his attention, but saw nothing except a couple of gambling West Highland Terriers and their male owner, who was walking along, swinging a pair of leads. "Cormoran?" Strike appeared to recall his attention from a long way away.
"What?" he said, and then, "Yeah. No, I was just..."
He turned to look back at the cafe, frowning.
"I was just thinking. But it's nothing I think I'm doing at all but seeing meaning in total coincidence."
"What coincidence?" But Strike didn't answer until the cafe doors opened and the three Bayliss sisters emerged in their coats.
"We should get going," he said. "They must be sick of the sight of us by now. I'll see you Monday. Let me know if you find out anything interesting on Betty Fuller."
Chapter 54. But nothing new to him was that same pain, nor pain at all, for he so oft had tried to power thereof, and loved so oft in vain. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The train gave a lurch. The sleeping Strike's head rolled sideways and hit the cold window. He woke, feeling drool on his chin. Wiping it on his coat sleeve, he peered around. The elderly couple opposite him were politely immersed in their reading material, but across the aisle, four teenagers were enjoying paroxysms of silent laughter, carefully not looking at him, their shoulders shaking as they feigned interest in the fields out of the window. Apparently, he'd been snoring with his mouth wide open, because it was now unpleasantly dry. Checking his watch, he saw that he'd been asleep at least 2 hours. Strike reached for the tartan thermos sitting on the table in front of him, which he'd rinsed out and refilled at McDonald's earlier, and poured himself a black coffee while the teenagers continued to gasp and snort with laughter. Doubtless they thought him comically odd and old, with his snores and his tartan thermos. But a year of navigating swaying train carriages had taught him that his prosthetic leg appreciated as few trips to the catering car as possible. He drank a cup of plastic-tainted coffee, then resettled himself comfortably, arms folded,
looking out at the fields gliding past, bestridden with power pylons, the flat white cloud given a glaucous glow by the dust on the glass. The landscape registered only incidentally. Strike's attention was focused inwards on the odd idea that had occurred to him after the interview with the Bayliss sisters. Of course, the idea might be nothing but the product of an overburdened mind making spurious connections between simple coincidences. He mentally turned it this way and that, examining it from different angles, until finally, yawning, he inched sideways over into the empty seat beside him and laboriously pulled himself up into a standing position in the aisle so he could access the hold-all in the luggage rack overhead. Beside his hold-all sat a Waitrose bag, because he'd made a detour into the supermarket on the way to Paddington Station, where he'd grabbed 3 Easter eggs for his nephews, or rather 3 chocolate hedgehogs, woodland friends, because they were relatively compact. Now, groping in his hold-all for the Demon of Paradise Park, he accidentally knocked over the carrier bag containing the chocolate. The uppermost hedgehog fell out. In his attempt to catch it, he accidentally batted it up into the air. The box bounced off the back of the elderly woman's seat, causing her to squeak in surprise, and the box hit the floor. The teenagers for whom Strike was unintentionally mounting a one-man comedy show were now openly gasping and crying with laughter. Only when Strike bent down awkwardly to pick up the now cracked chocolate hedgehog, one hand on the teenager's table to steady himself, did one of the young women spot the metal rod that served as his right ankle. He knew what she'd seen by the abrupt cessation of her laughter and the frantic whispered shushing of her friends. Panting, sweating, and now aware of half the carriage's eyes on him, he shoved the damaged hedgehog back into its bag, found the Demon of Paradise Park in his hold-all, and then, sweating slightly, but taking malicious pleasure in the po-faced shock of the teenagers beside him, sidled back into his window seat. After flicking through the book in search of the part he wanted to reread, Strike finally found the chapter 2/3 of the way through the book, entitled Capture. Thus far, Creed's relationship with landlady Violet Cooper had been key to his continuing safety. Violet herself admits that for the first 5 years of his tenancy, she'd never have believed harm of Den, who she saw as a lonely and gentle soul, fond of their sing-along evenings, and probably gay. However, the pains he'd once taken to keep Violet happy had begun to irk Creed. Where once he'd drugged her because he was planning to pound bones to dust in the basement or needed to load a corpse into the van by night, he now began lacing her gin and oranges with barbiturates purely to avoid the tedium of her company. Creed's manner towards Violet also changed. He became mean to her, taking the mickey when there was no need, saying nasty things, laughing at me for using the wrong words and stuff, treating me like I was stupid, which he'd never done before. I remember one time I was telling him about the place my brother bought when he retired, cottage in the country, everything lovely, and I said, "You should have seen the garden, his roses and a gazebo." And he laughed at me, Dennis. Well, jeered, really, because I'd said it wrong. "Gazebo," I'd said, and I've never forgotten it. He said, "Don't use words if you can't say 'em. You just look thick." It hurt my feelings. I hadn't seen that nasty side of him. I knew he was clever. He used to do the Times crossword every day, knew all the answers on Mastermind when we watched it together, but he'd never put me down before. Then, one night, he starts going on about my will. He wants to know who I'm going to leave the house to. He as good as asked me to leave it to him. I didn't like that. I wasn't an old woman. I wasn't planning to die any time soon. I changed the subject, but he started on it again a few nights later. I said, "Look, how do you think that makes me feel, Dennis, you going on like this, like I'm on my last legs? You're making me feel like you're going to do away with me." He got uppity and said it was all right for me, but he had nothing, no security or nothing. And what if he got turfed out on the streets by whoever I left the house to? And he flounced out. We made it up later, but it left a nasty taste. It would seem the height of foolhardiness for Creed to persuade Violet into changing her will and then kill her. Quite apart from having an obvious motive,